Welcome to my show, Startup Yoga with Aarti. And today we have a very special guest on our show, Usman Iftikhar. Now, Usman, you are a beacon of light for migrant founders in Australia, and you're a migrant yourself. So tell us a little bit about your experience, your journey. When did you come to Australia, and what were the challenges which you faced?
Yeah, it's a very big question, but thank you for having me. It's great to be here and great to be a part of this, you know, story. I'd say to begin with, my sort of background is I'm from Pakistan originally. I came here to Australia in 2013. So I started in Pakistan as an engineer, sort of worked there for a little bit, came here to do a master's in engineering management, and started Wollongong Uni, and then was looking for a lot of work and doing casual jobs like many other people, so driving the 7-Eleven, BP, very usual immigrant jobs. Was quite frustrated by it, and I wanted to do something more meaningful. So I decided that, I'm going to start my own business, because I was applying for jobs, but wasn't really getting anything meaningful. And that's how I, came across a social enterprise incubator program called School for Social Entrepreneurs, SSE, in Parramatta. Doing that program gave me a lot of confidence and support and networks to, start my own idea, which was a renewable energy sort of clean tech startup that failed, like many business ideas do when you're sort of starting out. But then I worked on a couple of other ideas that went really well, and then was always thinking about trying to solve a problem with entrepreneurship. And for me, that was this issue of unemployment, but particularly underemployment, that many immigrants and refugees were facing. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if we helped people like me who are in the sort of boat start their own businesses as an alternative to employment? And so that's how Catalyze was born. We had no background in incubators, accelerators, but just as thinking about how do we help support and empower new migrants and new refugees who come to Australia to start their own businesses. So that's how Catalyze was born in 2016, and it's been 7 years and we've been running that now. We've had lots of different people from across the world. So I guess the latest challenge was 750 people from 87 different countries.
Wow.
Our programs. They have had lots of different backgrounds, experiences, different kind of businesses. But the two predominant, I guess, areas that we've been working people with is tech and social enterprise, because that's where we're seeing the most kind of impact. And that's been happening.
Okay, now you told us about the challenges which you faced before starting Catalyzer. But we would also want to know, what are the challenges which you faced after starting Catalyzer?
Oh, lots of challenges. as a founder, as an entrepreneur, I'm sure you know that, there's so many things that, so many challenges you face. So first of all, the kind of things we want to help our, founders with, the same challenges that we face. So for example, not having access to a network. When you want to start a business, you need to be able to have investors, you want to have, the different networks and contacts and so on, customers and sort of potential supporters. And so, for a business, it's really hard to build that. But if you're an incubator accelerator, that's kind of your bread and butter, right? So you should be able to have more connections and more networks to be able to help them, right? So we are kind of in that business of supporting the networks. But we're almost like bootstrapping an incubator program, which is quite different and very challenging compared to even just bootstrapping a startup. So lots of challenges around, building a network, getting people involved into the work we're doing, getting support, financial support, particularly because we set up a not-for-profit. And as you know, it's hard to run a not-for-profit, but particularly when you're working on, issues that are more mainstream Australian issues. So, if you're working on homelessness or a poverty issue or domestic violence, it's everyone has that experience, but not everyone has an immigrant experience. So it's kind of helping in that particular space is also getting people to understand what the unique challenges are for migrants. It was a bit of a tough job, but I think we've been doing it all right for the last few years.
Okay, and so when you came in 2013, how have the times in Australia changed from back then to now?
So I guess there's some things have sort of changed and others unfortunately still remain the same. So what's changed is there's a lot more recognition of, kind of the skills and experiences that immigrants bring. I think we definitely have a lot less racism. And I'm not talking about, the overt racism, but even casual racism, things like that. People are just a lot more multicultural. The whole migrant community has grown a lot in Australia. And obviously it depends on where you are in Australia as well. But I think there's just people are a lot more accepting. There's more programs and opportunities that exist for international students, for migrants, refugees, which is really great. But there's some things that unfortunately we still haven't been able to resolve or still are similar to, you know, when I came here. So things like many people's skills are still not recognized, you know, it's still a pain in the ass to be able to try and work through the system and understand how do you go from, you know, like you've come to Australia, you might be skilled, you might be qualified, but then being able to find work or being able to start your business, there's just many different kind of hurdles you have to go through. So we've tried to simplify some of those things, but there's still lots and lots of barriers that unfortunately still exist.
Now, Catalyzer has also come a long way from when it started. So how is Catalyzer different from when it started to now?
Just completely different. So when we started, we we were basically a small organization which had, we were trying to basically run programs for migrants, refugees, and we were sort of modeling off other programs that we've seen in the market. So for example, with mentoring, with different workshops and sessions and things like that. But as we've run our programs over time, we've got a lot of feedback on, you know, like what's the right kind of duration of the program? How often should we run workshops? Who are the kind of mentors we should bring? You know, what are the different things that people find value out of? And so our programs have evolved and changed significantly since we started. So when we started, we had a 2 months pilot program. Now we've got two separate types of programs. We run a fellowship and an accelerator program, and then there are specific offerings for those kind of different programs. But I guess one of the key things that we've learned through this time is the biggest value the Catalyzer is providing is not in the programs. It's not in the workshops. It's not in the content or the knowledge. It's really in A, building confidence, and B, helping people find their community. So finding other entrepreneurs that they can be around and, you know, learn from and sort of who can support them in sort of thick and thin. Because as you know, starting a startup is not just a 3 months or a 6 months process. There's lots of, you know, you take one step forward, five steps back, and, you know, it's always, you know, there's lots of uncertainty. So be able to have that community is really important to can give you the right advice, who can help you with different things that you need. So I think that's one of the biggest things that we've sort of helped create. And we're really proud that many of our alumni are now coming back and helping support us in running our programs and improving our programs as well.
Now, I understand that you can't have favorites.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm not asking you to mention any of your favorites, but can you share success story of one of the migrant or refugee entrepreneurs who's been through the Catalyzer program?
As I said, we've had 750 plus people that have got organizations okay. that have gone through the program, so it's really hard to say this one. But we've got, you know, quite a few that I can think of top of my head. Someone is a company called Spiral Blue, which is a space tech company that is improving data processing capability for satellites. Fantastic startup, and you know, they work with defense. They've got some funding from Australian Space Agency. They've actually launched their hardware into space using like SpaceX's rockets and things like that. So literally out there. We've got some amazing social enterprises. For example, one called Creative Property, which is helping women learn about digital skills and get into tech. Also doing some entrepreneurship programs as well, really early stage. We've got Humanism, which is focusing on helping train women in India, like life skills, financial skills, things like that, and then figuring out a way to come to Australia, like bring their kind of, I guess, the things that they're making to Australia, selling them here, helping them provide their employment opportunities. We have people who are working on a HR tech startup or like a traditional SaaS. Like one is called the HR Partner. We've got Nanada, who's focused on reducing carbon footprint. So there's lots and lots of different ones. So I can keep going all day. It's really hard to sort of pick one, but yeah, we've had many amazing entrepreneurs and founders that have gone through the program. And one of the reasons why it's hard to compare is because they're all so different, both in terms of the industry they're focusing on and the kind of work they're doing or why they're doing it. So we'll give you an example of a company that we have, which is called Removal Brothers, which is something that's completely out of the box. And what they're doing is they are a traditional removalist company, but with a specific social enterprise goal, which is to help women and so family facing domestic violence, help them with a free move, right? So these guys run a traditional removalist company, but they also do this kind of work as well. So there's like all these kind of really interesting and new ideas that we've seen that have come through. We've had someone, there's a guy called Mahib who created a startup called Pluralist, which is doing watches. And again, it sounds really simple, but watches in different languages. So he was the one globally who realized that there was no analog watches in different languages. So he made one in Japanese and Arabic and other kind of languages as well. So again, like very sort of specific different ideas. So I don't know how to compare and see what's better, but they're all doing really well.
Okay, awesome. Now, a lot of the companies which go through Catalyzer are either climate impact, social impact. So what advice or what do you see as the biggest opportunities for social impact investors? And how can investors help support innovative solutions to pressing global challenges?
So I guess the it's again, it's such a big question, right? Like, you know, what can investors do? Investors can do a lot in terms of supporting companies, but particularly when it comes to climate or social impact, you know, there's a huge now field of, you know, either clean tech or impact investing, whereas lots of investors are sort of recognizing the need to not just purely have a financial return, but also have a social or environmental return. And so I think what investors can really do is be open to new ideas, and also realize that some of the problems that many of these entrepreneurs are solving are not just social or environmental problems, but they also can create a lot of revenue and a lot of growth as well. So when you look at climate, for example, climate change is one of the biggest existential threats that we all face right now. And particularly in you know, countries like, you know, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, where, you know, it's, you know, lots of people face this problem. If you can solve these problems in a meaningful way, there's lots, not just, you know, you're not just helping people, there's a lot of money to be made as well. So from an investor standpoint, you can have impact and you can also have a return as well. So don't think that they are sort of the opposite. And we've seen many startups that have sort of proven that in the last few years.
Okay, now you personally and Catalyzer as an accelerator supports a lot of women founders. And you've spoken very vocally about that, how we should support women and girl entrepreneurs. So what do you believe are the most effective strategies for increasing women participation in the field?
Again, this is one of those areas where I'm not, this is not my area of expertise. It's hard to know, but what I think, like, what you can do to have more women involved, and what we've done successfully is, one is to be able to have women on your leadership team. So whether that's, you know, the core team that's helping deliver the programs, also, you know, in terms of governance and things like that, because that really helps you get the kind of advice and feedback that you need. So, you know, from very early days of Catalyzer, our advisory board had a lot of women, also particularly migrant women and migrant women who are entrepreneurs. Our entrepreneurs residents, a majority of them are actually female migrant women entrepreneurs as well. So again, they've brought that experience, they understand the kind of specific needs and gaps that exist, and also how to market to that community as well. So lots of different things, but it's not just, you know, enough to attract people into the programs that you run, but also then how do you support them in a specific way, because there's some things that, you know, like women understand about women that they can do better sort of job at. So what we found is having you know, other women entrepreneurs, because there are lots of them involved in all stages of process, designing your programs and delivering a program can make a huge difference. And then also just, you know, like treating women as people. I know it sounds pretty simple, but it often doesn't happen like that. Oftentimes, you know, we all have our biases, and I'm not saying that we don't have our biases, we definitely do. But it's thinking about, you know, how do you look at an entrepreneur, look at their ideas and support them for what they're trying to achieve, what their mission is, rather than, like, you know, what their gender is, what their color of skin is, what kind of, you know, what their background is, and so really it's focusing on, like, what kind of opportunity they're trying to target and then supporting them doing that.
Okay, now how important do you think diversity is, and do you believe diversity and inclusivity play in fostering innovation and creating successful startups?
Absolutely. I mean, I think diversity is really, really critical, and not just critical in the sense that, you know, you need to have different ideas, but also because you want people from different experiences so they can come at problems from different ways. So what's essentially, you know, if you think about what a startup is basically a set of problems you're solving, right? So initially you think of a bigger problem you're trying to solve, but then once you build your business, you know, you're like, one of the problems you're trying to solve is, how do I get money? You know, how do I, you know, get to the right customer and, you know, market to my product? How do I, you know, build a team? All these kind of different problems you're solving throughout your life cycle. And what you need is people from different backgrounds, different experiences, so they can come at the problem from different ways and solve those problems. And the thing that, I guess, puts startups apart from existing other businesses, particularly large companies, is their rate of movement. So how quickly they can move and change and grow. And, you know, like when you are in that current situation, you want the best solution. So if you want to get the best solutions, you want to get as many different kind of people thinking about a problem to be able to solve those problems. And when you look at some really successful teams that have done a great job on building something, yes, you might see like a big name entrepreneur in the front, but there's lots of people behind it and many of those teams that are doing, you know, great jobs. So a great example of that is OpenAI. If you look for a CTO of OpenAI right now, he's a woman of color. And, you know, but like when you think about OpenAI, you obviously think of Sam Altman as the person behind, like, you know, in front. Yeah. Not that Sam's the one taking the credit, but just as an example of, you know, how there's many people involved in kind of doing this sort of startup innovation process. And so that diversity really helps drive innovation forward.
Okay, now let's take a step back and discuss about where, like, how is it that you got where you got? Now, you've worked at very unique places globally, and from Siberia to South America. During your time in these places, did you experience any cultural shocks, and how did you work through them?
That's a great question. I think that, I mean, I've had the privilege to work in a few different parts of the world, and I think the biggest thing is that there's always been like new experiences and new learnings, and oftentimes you experience or you think about, you know, people a certain way, or you make assumptions like we all do, just to be able to sort of try and do something, and you realize that you're wrong, right? So when you think of, for example, Siberia or Russia, you know, like many people have kind of like their own kind of opinion on stuff. Yeah. Some things are absolutely right, like true. Vodka. Everyone loves vodka there. That's a thing, right? Yeah. But there are things that they're not like. They're not beers in the street walking around. Like, I went to Siberia, this is 2011, and they had 30 degree days with palm trees. So wow. When you think about it, it's not like a minus 70. And it still happens sometimes in the winter, yeah. But with climate change, all the kind of things happening, the sort of landscape has changed significantly. People are really lovely, you know, very supportive and that kind of thing. So it's like, oftentimes you can think of, okay, well, what does a Russian person look like, or what does a someone from Africa or Europe or whatever. But when you work with people on sort of one-on-one level, you realize that many of the people are the same. We've got the same kind of issues, problems, and we all have the same kind of aspirations of, like, you know, supporting our families, you know, building a life for ourselves. So oftentimes I think, like, yes, there are culture shocks and things are different in different parts of the world, but it's like connecting with people on similarities and then where you kind of, you know, agree, and then working from there. So I found that, you know, like, wherever I've been to, and I've been really privileged to go and work in many different places, it's always been like trying to find common ground with different people, and then seeing how we can work together, and that's been really effective.
Now, given that you've told us that 750 founders have gone through the Catalyzer program, I'm sure you met thousands of people and you've touched millions of lives. Now, who is the most influential person in your life, or somebody who's had a really deep impact on your life? Could be professionally, could be personally, and what was it?
Again, this is one of those things which is really hard, because, you know, like, there are, I guess, people in the sense that they've, like, written something or done something, you know, that I've sort of taken inspiration from. So I'm talking about, like, in history, and then also people, like, living human beings that have supported me and the work that we're doing. So when I think about, you know, some of the inspirations of people that I've looked up to, or, like, you know, like, I'm really fascinated by, so people like Nikola Tesla is one of those guys who's just absolutely, you know, an immigrant, you know, doing a fantastic kind of job and what he was doing. You know, when you think about Einstein is another example, who was a refugee, no one talks about it, but, you know, like, just changing the game in like physics. Or you think of Da Vinci, he's another guy who's an immigrant, and like the kind of things that he's been doing. Again, we don't think of those people, we think of them as artists or engineers or other people, entrepreneurs, but we don't think about them as immigrants. Sure. And so when you think about many of those people's stories and like their immigrant stories, that's like an interesting way of looking at things, and that's something that's inspired me in the past. Another person who has, like, well, one book that's deeply personally affected me is a book called A Man's Search for Meaning by a guy called Viktor Frankl, who was a Jew, you know, stuck in the you know, concentration camps, was very lucky to make it out alive. He was a psychologist, wrote a book about meaning of life. Again, it's sort of really heavy, deep stuff, but so there's, like, again, lots of different people that, you know, like, I've had the, you know, privilege of getting inspired by, you know, like, in history, but then also even now, you know, for example, our sort of board chair Alan is one of those guys, and I think you've met him as well, Alan Jones, a really lovely guy, really supportive, really helpful, and has helped us throughout the process. So as I said, when I started working at Catalyzer, I had no idea how to do this on startups, entrepreneurship, or on incubators, right. But he's helped guide us a lot, because he's been an entrepreneur resident in many programs, has been really good at, you know, supporting different kind of programs as well. So yeah, it's just been so many people. It's really hard to say and pick one person, you know, that you'll say this is the person that was my motivation. It's just like lots and lots of different people.
So just for our viewers, fun fact, Alan Jones is a startup mentor who helped Yahoo grow in Australia for the first time when it had launched. So hats off to you, Alan. Okay, now, I personally salute migrants and founders and people who moved away from their own country, from their origin, of course, and moved to another country and, you know, given so much just to develop and see themselves grow. Now, talking about the time when you started Catalyzer and took a big risk in your career and personal life, and not thinking about, okay, what's next for me? I'm leaving behind so much. How is it all going to go? Tell us about that experience and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, look, I think that when I think of and sort of reflect on my experience, I don't think it was as risky, because I think it was risky to continue doing what I was doing. And I know that sounds weird, but really, because I was not like working as an engineer, I wasn't working in technology. I was just, you know, working at a 7-Eleven or, you know, BP or whatever, doing the same kind of shift over and over again. That was sort of affecting my own personal mental health, and that's something that I definitely didn't want. So I feel like to start a business was such a logical next step. It was, it's like, well, no one's going to give me a job. I'm going to start my own job. And there was no risk involved, because it's not like I was building a huge kind of company with lots of money. We had no money, no connections, nothing. We'll just get started. And we were like, you know, what's the worst thing that will happen? If it doesn't work out, we'll go back and we'll apply for more jobs, right? Because we're applying for jobs anyway. So I don't think there was like as much of a, I guess, kind of risk in the early days. What I can say, though, is that over time, and this has happened to many entrepreneurs and founders, you know, who start this way, as you sort of continue to grow and your work, you know, does well and people know about you and so on, there is this kind of reputational risk where, you know, you tend to become very kind of straightforward and you're like, okay, we'll only do certain things and we won't get, you know, you sort of sometimes lose that innovative sort of passion because you're like, you can't do some things, and you know, you want to be known as like, you know, this person who's like always right, or you know, whatever. So oftentimes people start playing it safe. So I think one thing that I'm sort of privileged and really lucky to do is like just always look at new opportunities and think about, you know, new things to do, and take risks, even now, not caring about whether this idea is going to work or fail. Because if you do care about that, then that means you're already, you know, thinking sort of, you know, that sort of innovation kind of mindset. So I've got like a space tech startup that I'm working on at the moment. Who knows if it's going to work or not? Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I'm working with Daniel on a fund, as you know, as well, to be able to invest in immigrant entrepreneurs. We don't know where it's going to go, but we're really looking forward to making it grow. So lots of these kind of different projects that I'm always involved in, and many of them don't work out. So sometimes you haven't heard of them because they haven't worked out. And so I think it's important for people to, you know, I think that when they're thinking about risk is, you know, you've got to take certain risks, and then some of them will work out, but many won't. And so you have to be open to that possibility and still keep trying and keep going.
Right. Now, 2019-2021 were, how I would say, is dangerous years for a lot of founders. A lot of them became multi-million dollar companies, and a lot of them sort of just got wiped off. How do you think COVID has impacted refugee and migrant founders, and in general, migrants as people?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's really complex, and it depends on, I mean, where you're based. So we're both country-wise, but also we're in, like, you know, in Australia. So, for example, people's experience in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane is not the same because lockdowns and all the kind of other things. But what we have seen across the board, at least with some of the companies and people that we've supported, is firstly, there was obviously the borders were closed. So what that meant was new people were not coming, but you couldn't go back, right? So as you know, many immigrants have their own families in different countries. And, you know, with refugees, a bit more complex. With many sort of skilled migrants, for example, who've come here, you know, who are building a life here, they still might have a lot of their family in other countries. And to be able to sort of not see them for a long period of time can be, you know, problematic, especially if they're getting sick or, you know, with COVID or like any other kind of symptoms and things that are happening and not being able to travel. And I've seen that firsthand where people really, really struggle with that. Some people, unfortunately, they're like parents or their sort of loved ones passed away, which was, again, you know, like the impact of that on a personal person, but also, you know, on a business is huge. But then, you know, on the other side, we've also seen particularly people who are building tech and like digital solutions really see their business grow through the roof, because everyone, particularly in Australia, was digitalizing, so they had lots more opportunities to go and sort of tackle that. So it's really hard. It's like everyone had a kind of different mixed experience. But I think the thing that I've seen is many of the entrepreneurs from migrant refugee backgrounds have sort of made it through the other end. And the reason why is because they're generally a lot more resilient than a general founder. And I think that's probably because of their journey of being, you know, an immigrant and coming to a new country. So when you move to a new country, you know, you're okay with uncertainty, you're okay with doing new things. And, you know, like, so everything is new. And so, you know, like, having COVID as, like, you know, and lockdown, these kind of things, you know, it might be just one small thing as a part of your whole migrant experience. It's one of those things, but, you know, like, many people have gone, like, yeah, okay, well, this is something that happened as a part of our experience where we move on and we do better stuff. So it's been interesting. And you know, like, I've seen, obviously, people have had mental health, like, affected and all those kind of things. I think it didn't affect my girl. You know, maybe as much unless they were doing like something like in retail or whatever, which sort of got shut down. But particularly for new migrants or international students or those kind of communities, they've had more impacts because they, you know, for example, didn't get access to JobKeeper or, you know, JobSeeker and all those kind of things and, I guess, incentives that the government put out. And so that was really unfortunate. And so I think that that's probably have a longer-term impact on Australia. But for migrant entrepreneurs who are already set up and going, I think it wasn't as bad.
Now, what are some of the most unexpected lessons that you've learned over the course of your career and have been able to pass them on to your founders as well, who you mentor?
Unexpected lessons. I think one probably unexpected lesson is just going back to the same point that I was talking about earlier about community. When, again, this, we've got this very specific notion of, you know, you want to start a business, you want to start a startup, you've got to, you know, have long sleepless nights, do it all your own, you know, like be this sort of crazy founder like a Steve Jobs or whatever. And, you know, I mean, Steve Jobs didn't build Apple on his own, but even if he did, it wouldn't be, you know, like that's a one out of many million and billions of people. Right? So it's like really knowing the value of community. And I think that's one of the things that, I mean, I did not go into entrepreneurship thinking that that's one of the key takeaways that I'll have. It, like, I was like, okay, maybe it's about how do you make money better? How do you grow your startup? How do you, like, all the kind of other things? But it was actually about the value of people and the value of community. And that's at all levels. So, you know, both, I mean, because we're running accelerators, obviously there's community there, but also within our team, kind of setting up the right kind of culture, being in a community of other founders across the ecosystem and working with them and learning from them, I think is another thing. So that was something that I wasn't expecting, but that's something that came out. The second thing that was an unexpected lesson, I think this is more Australian specific, is when you look at most of the literature or videos or whatever about like starting a startup or being a founder, it's seen as a very, very competitive kind of thing.
Yeah.
And mostly that's because, you know, it's coming out of the US and a very sort of different mentality.
Yeah.
In Australia, we are a lot more cooperative. So I've seen that many organizations are collaborating a lot. I mean, you know, especially in the not-for-profit space, we're always sharing resources, thinking about, you know, grants that we can apply for together, all this kind of work. So I think that's another thing that I knew when I sort of started joining, I didn't expect that. Something that, you know, we'll see so many people willing to support, whether that's organizations or individuals. But, like, you know, if you're doing something meaningful and, you know, like that resonates with people, you will get lots and lots of volunteers and lots and lots of support, which I think wasn't something that I was expecting when we started this work.
Okay. Now, given that you wear so many hats, how do you manage the work-life balance? How do you get rid of the stress?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't. The short answer. Look, work-life balance is a hard thing, and I think it also depends on, you know, like what your sort of life circumstances are. So for some people, for example, if they, you know, if they're single or in a relationship, if they've got kids, you know, what kind of like their, I guess, sort of personal goals are, financial, all the kind of other things. So I think for me, it's like making sure that I know when I'm overcommitting and not doing that, because I've burnt out a couple of times before and that wasn't good. I think the other thing that I used to do, particularly during COVID, was like really good exercise and healthy eating. I have sort of let that go for a while, but I'll sort of go back to that and like to try to get back into, you know, exercise and healthy eating and all that kind of stuff. But essentially just making sure that, you know, you at least have like one day a week that's focused on you. So whether that's, you know, just watching Netflix, doesn't matter, or, you know, just like, you know, doing some other binge YouTube shorts, whatever it is, right? Just take your time off from the work. I think it's really important. So taking care of yourself, taking care of, and like spending time with your family, friends, other people that you know care about, that's outside of work, is something that I found is really important. And making time for those things, even amongst all the kind of other schedule you have, and realizing that, you know, like if, for example, something doesn't get done on Friday or Monday, it can happen the next day. Oftentimes we put like really strong, I guess, sort of deadlines for ourselves, and sometimes they're not as strong. But something obviously needs to be delivered at certain points of time, but other things, you know, a bit more flexible. So I guess knowing that and knowing what are the things you want to focus on, and prioritization is something that's a learned skill, so it comes with time. One of the coaches that I've had who's really helped me with this is he's got a model which is called the 1-3-5 model.
Yeah.
And the 1-3-5 model is, you know, normally we, again, this is how brains are wired, where we try to do like a easy task, or send out an email today, I'll do this, but I wouldn't do anything like a big chunk of work or something meaningful.
Right.
But basically the 1-3-5 model is, you know, sit down every day before you start doing something and write down what is that one thing you want to achieve today. So if you do nothing else, just one thing you want to achieve. That could be a major project, that could be like writing something, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Just that one thing. And if you get that one thing done, you're going to be happy that you had a successful day. If you do that, then you think about the next three kind of like, you know, medium type of tasks that you could do, and then the five are, you know, like all the kind of other tasks that you have. Anything that doesn't make that list, you should be doing anyway. But like, it's not important, not urgent, but like, definitely focus on the one. If you get the one done, then you know you've got a lot more, I guess, motivation to do the other three. But normally we start the other way around. We start with a small task, and then by the time we get to the bigger task, we just don't have any energy. It's just for changing that. And then the other key thing that I've learned is managing your energy rather than managing your time. And so when you're working in a job, obviously, you know, if it's a 9 to 5 or whatever, you're told to go to work, you know, sit down in front of a computer or whatever your job is, do that job for a few hours, and then, you know, go for a lunch, come back, kind of like very sort of scheduled like that. But actually, when you're working in innovation, or when you're working in, like, you know, doing all sorts of things, there's no set time, there's no set kind of way in which you should work. What I found is, you know, like, I could try to manage my energy. So, for example, if I'm working from home and I realize that I'm not being productive, I'll just leave the home. I'll go to a library, I'll go work from a co-working space somewhere else, just a cafe, and just do something. Or, like, there's some days where you know you're not productive, take a day off, it's fine, right? Just come back to it tomorrow. But as a founder, it's really important to know when, like, there's no point in pushing against the wall.
Yeah.
And so I think it's like managing your energy and managing your time, sort of managing that. That's something that's really important, is like focusing on the energy rather than the time, because time is an arbitrary concept. But energy, when you know when you're tired, you know when you're not going to work more, go to sleep, wake up, do it again, rather than, you know, the other way around.
Okay. Now, Catalyzer, over a period of time, has, you know, collaborated and partnered with some great organizations. Now, how have these collaborations contributed to the success personally and Catalyzer's success as well?
Look, we would not be able to do anything without collaboration and support. So we've got organizations at all levels that support us. So we've had organizations that support us with recruitment, so whether that's universities, whether that's, you know, not-for-profit organizations who are helping immigrants and refugees, whether that's, you know, other kind of organization in the ecosystem, other accelerators who can help us with, like, running the programs. So without that kind of support, we would not get anywhere. And we also try to sort of pay it back and sort of help them as well when we can. Then there is the support that we've had, financial support, which is, you know, essential. Obviously, without that, you can't run an organization. So, you know, like, sort of foundations, corporate foundations, high net worth individuals, or other kind of, like, you know, people like that who have donated money to us. It's been critical, because that's helped us go from, you know, where we were at the beginning to growing and scaling now. And again, without this, it wouldn't happen. And third, I guess, the key cohort of people are the mentors, because we've had many different volunteer mentors have come. So it's like over 1,000 people that have helped us over the last, you know, 7 years. And they've been really instrumental in helping many of these entrepreneurs, because when you think about particularly scaling up the model that we had, I can't speak to all the 700 people, right? But we've had people, you know, who've gone through to Catalyzer. Sometimes they're alumni, they're coming back and mentoring. Others that are, you know, through our partner organizers have come in as well and being a mentor as well. So that's the kind of thing that's been really helpful. And so, yeah, definitely, if it was just me or a small team, we would not be able to do it. It's only because of the community of all these kind of collaborators and organizations that have been able to do what we are doing.
Awesome. Now, looking ahead, what are your goals for Catalyzer and your broader work in tech and social impact?
Again, it's a huge question, because it depends on, like, what kind of time scale you're looking at. So for me personally, essentially, there's a sort of, you know, short to medium term goal and, like, a very long term goal. So short to medium term goal for us is we've been able to run our programs in Australia. Now we're looking to take it internationally. So we are, you know, taking our work. We've already done some pilots in New Zealand. We'll look at doing some more stuff in Europe and other countries as well. So that's one of the key things we want to do this year. So we want to sort of take our programs and our work internationally. The second thing, I guess, that we are looking at is also making our work sustainable, because, as I mentioned, we are set up as a not-for-profit. And as you know, not-for-profits, you know, reliant on other grants and things like that. It's hard to make that sustainable. And so we've got a separate organization, which is Catalyzer Pty Limited. It's a social enterprise. And we do consulting work through that organization to get revenue to sort of top up around the foundation. And so the other goal that we have is to scale up this for-profit entity through different kind of consulting work, and then use that revenue to help us become independent of other kind of external funding. So that's another thing that we're focusing on over the next sort of 2 to 5 years. And then I guess finally, the more longer term goal for us is really looking at, you know, how do we both change the narrative around migration? Because if we help more immigrants, refugees, starting their own businesses, and, like, share those stories, then, you know, we believe that we can change the narrative. The data is already there, but, like, we need more stories, and we need more sort of case studies for people to sort of think differently about migrants and refugees and the kind of value they bring to the Australian economy. But the second thing that I'm really passionate about is, again, this sort of problem of climate change. And I think that with climate change, we have a short window of action that we are doing now in terms of like mitigating effects of climate change. But also long term, we will see lots of climate migration. So there's some numbers which are really, really harrowing. Like there's a study that was done in 2017 by Cornell University in the US, which showed that we could have up to 2 billion climate refugees or climate migrants by the end of the century, right? So when you think about it, right now we've got about 100 million refugees, that's including Ukraine, Afghanistan, everything, and we as a globe cannot deal with that, right? We don't know, many people are languishing in refugee camps. With skilled immigrants, there's lots and lots of issues, as you know. So when you think about that problem, and like 10xing or 100xing that to 2 billion people, which will be probably like 1 in 10 of the global population, or 1 in 5 of the global population at that time, of like 10 to 11 billion. So that's a huge number. And we need to think about migration differently. We need to think about, the value that immigrants bring to different countries differently. I'm not proposing that I will be the one to solve that problem, but we want to be part of a global ecosystem of organisations that can do that. So we've already set up a global refugee entrepreneurship network, which is run out of the UK, where there's other organisations like Catalyzer that are doing this kind of work, banding together, thinking about how do you shape narrative, how do you shape policy globally, and how do you get more funding to this kind of work. So it's a long-term play, and we don't know how it will go in the future, but that ultimately that's where we're driving towards.
Awesome. We definitely need more accelerators, more thoughts like Catalyzer. Now, any last advice before we hop onto our rapid fire round?
Advice for who's the audience?
For the founders and entrepreneurs.
I think the biggest advice for founders is just do it. I know it sounds very cliched, but oftentimes, I've seen many founders who are stuck in sort of analysis paralysis loop where they're thinking of, I'm going to do this research, I'll do this planning, and then I'll go out there and do it. Trust me, you can make as many plans as you want. As soon as you actually get out of the market, your plan is not going to work because there's the market's shifted, things have changed. So it's always good to get out there and do stuff and then learn from the experience and then improve. It can be scary, but many people just don't have the confidence or don't want to try it. But trust me, you will not regret it. Get out there, do stuff today. Even if it's a very small thing, make a landing page, talk to 5 people about what you're doing, just do something. And if you take action, entrepreneurship is about action, it's not about thinking. So that's the key thing to take away, is just do something.
Okay, awesome. Now, starting with a rapid fire round, and you don't have much time to think, what is the first thing that you do when you wake up in the morning?
Unfortunately, look at my phone. So I don't want to do that. I want to say that I've got a better habit, but I don't. I look at my phone, look at different messages and things that I've gotten. Not a great habit, but it is what it is.
Okay, now talking about phone, which is most preferred, Android or Apple?
This is a tough question. I'm going to skip. No, I would say Apple. And the reason why I say Apple is for a few reasons. So I used to have Android for a long time. Now I've got Apple. Is because of privacy. I think that's one of the biggest things. You don't know, especially being in the tech ecosystem, you understand this a bit better, but how many apps and how many sort of companies are taking your data without your permission? And Android, it's a free-for-all kind of thing almost. And again, this is what I know. So, if I'm wrong, please tell me. But with Apple, you can actually control every single app and the privacy and all that kind of stuff. So that's really, really great. I think the other thing is also what I really like about Apple is all the connectivity in between. And I know Android and different kind of people are also trying to work on that now. But, anything you have, for example, on your phone, just connect to your Mac, connect to your iPod, all the kind of different things that are out there. And so that is really, really seamless in terms of kind of the work you have to do. And so, again, but that's probably more habits in the work you're doing. But I like Apple for those reasons, but it's ridiculously expensive. So there's that downside, unfortunately, for having Apple.
Now, given that you're from Asia and now you live in Melbourne, you're a diehard Melbournean, tea or coffee?
I would go with tea.
Okay.
Do you want to know why?
Yeah, sure.
So tea, because I had lots and lots of coffees and then I was having a bit of a heart problem and I was like, I can't deal with it. So I love coffee, but I can't drink too much of it. So tea it is.
Okay. Now, beach or mountains?
Mountains, yeah.
Okay. What's your favorite hobby outside work?
Cricket. So I love playing cricket and watching cricket, all of cricket.
Nice. You have mentioned that in your favorite free time, you binge watch, you do Netflix. Which is the last thing you've binge watched?
It's a good question on binge watching. I don't know if I've binge watched anything recently, but the last show or the thing that I've recently watched is an anime. It's called Attack on Titan. And yeah, it's I'm not going to spoil it for you. It's getting to its finale. It's been like going on for many years, but it's really, really fun.
Okay, now the next question was, which is the most innovative startup you've come in the come across in the last few years? Need not be from Catalyzer. It could be.
That's I don't know if I can answer that, because that's, you know, like, what defines the most innovative, right? Like, for who?
No, according to you, like.
It's a very hard question. Because every kind of, you know, like, everyone's sort of creating an innovation. How do you compare?
Okay, let me rephrase the question. Yeah. Is there any technology which you've come across recently and you can't just do without it?
Okay, I think maybe I've come back to the innovative question now that I'm thinking about it. I mean, there's kind of two separate streams. So one is quantum tech.
Yeah.
There's a lot happening in that space that I do not understand or, you know, care to understand, but that's something that if they're able to commercialize it, can make a huge difference. Another area that I do understand a bit of it is energy, because there's a company out of the US, which is Helios Energy. They say that they've cracked nuclear fusion, which, if they are able to create a commercial kind of reactor, then that basically solves global energy need, which is a big thing. So that's a huge innovation. Again, I don't know, they've raised a lot of money, so hopefully they're on the track. But the other one that I think everyone knows now is ChatGPT, right? Like, that's the common one, and it's not because of what it can do now, but it's like looking at what it was like maybe 3 to 5 years ago, and what it, and like what the, I guess, the scale of AI and how quickly AI is changing. And so I think it's already very ubiquitous in our life with everything we do with artificial intelligence, but I feel like in the next 10 years, like, we will get so many users out of AI that you can't even imagine right now. And it's not because, you know, like, it's a cool thing to do, but because it's becoming a lot more cheaper, a lot more accessible.
Yeah.
And it's just become a big tool that we can use for all of our stuff. So I think that's one of those innovations that have gotten the whole world thinking about AI. And so I think the kind of innovation that will come out of that will be really exciting.
Nice. Okay. Now.
Sorry, it was like quick fire, but I went for a long time.
No, that's all good. Any favorite quotes from any books, movies?
Quotes. I think this is probably more from, I think Elon Musk had this quote, which I know Elon Musk is a bit of a divided personality at the moment. But this is, if something is important enough, you do it even if the odds are not in your favor. So I think that's this really nice quote that he's had. Which is quickly building SpaceX and Tesla and all the kind of companies that he's built.
Okay, one biggest misconception people have about startup accelerators?
I think the biggest misconception people have about startup accelerators and the kind of support in general is that the thing they do is give money. And all the value is in actually getting the money and the funding. That's not true. We don't give any funding, but even organizations that do give funding, the biggest value add is not in funding. It's about introductions, networks, confidence, literally everything else but money. And so I think that's the biggest misconception. Generally, with founders, that they think the biggest thing they need in the beginning is money, but they don't. They need to work on their product. They need to get kind of right kind of advice, connections, customers. And if they figure all that stuff out, money will follow.
Awesome. Okay, now before we let you go, the last one thing on your bucket list which you want to do soon.
I want to go to the Great Barrier Reef and do snorkeling and, you know, enjoy it. It's always been on my bucket list, but I haven't done it yet.
Awesome. Thanks a ton for being on our show, Usman, and we wish you all the success for all your future endeavors. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fantastic.
Thank you. See ya.
Cheers.